History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. I've mentioned in the past on this podcast that I'm from Iowa, which has a reputation of being a slightly backwards country bumpkin farm state. And that view is partially fair. We do have a state fair every year where a cow is made out of a one-ton gigantic block of butter. But I've also argued on this podcast that Iowa has made incredible contributions to global civilization. It standardized the English language, saved billions of people from starvation in the 20th century due to innovations in agriculture. Our optimism and tinkering spirit created Silicon Valley. We have incredible political power through the Iowa caucuses. And lastly, and most counterintuitively, we are the multicultural capital of the world due to the many utopian communities that took root here in the 19th century. This episode will be further dispelling some of the ideas of the Midwest as being this backwater bastion, and I'm welcomed by guest Kristen Hoganson, who's the author of the book, The Heartland in American History. An idea of the Midwest is a place where the United States exists in its most pristine, unadulterated form. And it's sort of a holdout from the world that's globalizing and it's left it behind with its studio apartments and tram lines. But as Kristen explains, that's not the case. Originally, the Midwest was occupied by the Kickapoos, an Algonquin people who roamed through the Midwest and Canada. Then it was occupied by cattle production that stretched from Mexico to Ontario. And in this borderland of the United States, there was a unique multinational identity. And when you get in the early 20th century, farmers who read the Old Farmer's Almanac have more of an interest in global news as they're following global trade and shipping routes than they are interested in local news. So this story gets into the long, tangled roots of America's past. I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kristen Hoganson. Kristen, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Scott.
Well, I am very excited to talk to you about this. I am from Iowa, and I slightly tongue-in-cheek, but not completely, have argued in the past that Iowa is the multinational center of the world and responsible for saving civilization. So a little over the top, but you know, I think there's some nuggets of truth in there. So when you were planning on writing this book, were there any aha moments that you had as you were looking at the Midwest that made you want to debunk the idea of the Midwest as this insular, static place that doesn't change?
There are a ton of moments like that. And the first one was the moment that led to the book, which originated with my move to East Central Illinois, to downstate Illinois, in the middle of the Corn Belt. And when I arrived, I turned on the radio and I got weather forecasts for China, Argentina, and Brazil. And that was my first aha moment. And the aha was, I have no idea where I've landed. I did not expect this. What in the heck is going on? So that was sort of the precipitating event that made me curious about the backstory to this region. But every chapter has aha moments where I discover things that I just had no idea existed. So let me give you one more example, which is about birds. And I'm thinking about it because of the news stemming from the pandemic is that a lot more people are taking up bird watching since they're just looking out of their windows at home. And that reminded me of the chapter I have on economic ornithology. So let me explain that. So rural people, including in the Midwest, have long depended on migratory birds, in part for protein, but also for insect pest control before the era of synthetic pesticides. And when bird populations started to plummet in the early 19th century, they became a major constituency for bird protection legislation, including international treaties, which significantly were negotiated by the Department of Agriculture because they recognized the importance of birds for food security. And then as part of that whole effort, then farmers in the Midwest became audiences for trying to figure out bird migrations. You know, in a time before there was kind of like, you know, radar tracking or, you know, the banding capacity, it was a major collective enterprise to figure out where birds went, migratory birds in the summer and winter. And farmers were not only part of the effort in terms of recording their observations, but major audiences for trying to figure out those geographies of connection. which they realize connected them to, you know, the far north, northern Canada, as well as to places in the Caribbean, Central America, South America.
You're right. There are a lot of international connections there. And when people think of farmers as backwater country bumpkins, like when Mike Bloomberg said, I could train anyone to become a farmer, plant a seed in the ground, as if it's 1920 and that's how you farm. An uncle of mine has been to Brazil numerous times to speak with other farmers there with the international corn trade. And my alma mater, Iowa State University, has the highest per capita of Brazilians in the ergonomics department and others. But something that kicks off your book that I'm curious about is you immediately reframe the Midwest or the heartland as being sort of this fortress of traditional identity or whatever, and reconstruct it as a borderland, as a place where different cultures intermingle with the Kickapoo peoples. Could you describe how they fit into this early story of the Midwest and how it reframes that idea?
Yeah, so let me talk about three things. So starting with the connections to Brazil, I just have to jump in and say they predate our own time period, including, you know, like commodity trading. Illinois farmers, among others, are investing in land in Brazil. But even back in the earliest years of the 20th century, there were connections. So an early dean of agriculture at the University of Illinois came to the post, though he was Michigan born, he came to the post from Brazil, where he had gone to establish an agricultural college. And those experiences in Brazil were really important to his later work here on the campus where I teach. So just, you know, backstory to these Brazilian connections. As for thinking about borderlands and the Kickapoos, that the stories are in some ways the same, but they also in some ways are a bit different in terms of some of my findings. So in terms of thinking about borderlands, I find that people in the rural Midwest were involved in border crossing economic relationships that went both to the north and the south. So one of the things that I think the word Midwest conveys is a lateral idea of place. So the Midwest identifies this region of the country as somewhere between the far west and, I don't know, the near west, the more proximate west. So you think about it on an east-west axis, which is a national axis. But if you tilt the axis north-south, you realize, in fact, there have been just as many connections that have flown in that direction that have, among other things, connected Midwestern farmers to a large degree to farmers like in Ontario, among other places, who they collaborated with, understood as part of a common agricultural community, and in some cases, as in the case of importing high-end livestock for breeding purposes, were a really important part of their economic system. And that this system then mapped onto also human connections of human mobility north and south across the U.S.-Canadian border. And then ditto, I look to the south and find that, for example, the shorthorn cattle producers of the Midwest, once they started feedlot fattening operations where they would feed livestock corn before it was butchered, they would import animals for fattening purposes from Texas and Indian Territory back in the 19th century, and in many cases from Mexico. And the Mexican animals often were just labeled Texan animals. Like the full extent of the Mexican trade was not fully appreciated, unless there were times of disease outbreaks, in which case the Mexicanness was always highlighted in the press. And the point of this particular story is that these farmers in the middle were thinking in the 19th century about how to establish borders on a time when there really was no border patrolling or very minimal border patrolling. And they reached very different conclusions about how the U.S.-Canadian border should be kind of monitored and enforced than the conclusions about how the U.S.-Mexican border should be monitored and enforced. And a lot of their conclusions had to do with their understandings of animals, that they understood understood often in racialized terms, as like Northern European aristocratic animals from Canada versus mongrel animals descended from African stock that could be traced back to Spain with its connections to North Africa in the time of Cortez. And they extended their ideas about animals to people, and their ideas about how to manage animal mobility to ideas about how to enforce borders for human mobility. So that's the borderland story. And then thinking about the Kickapoos, their history is one of just astounding mobility to people who are unfamiliar with Native American histories more generally. In the time of Columbus, most Kickapoos lived in what is now the Detroit, Michigan, Windsor, Ontario area. And because of the violence of the fur trade, they got pushed by the Iroquois out of that area more into places like Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa. And then were removed by the pioneers in the 19th century into places like Kansas and Oklahoma. And some Kickapoos went as far south as Mexico, where they wouldn't be subject to the same kind of surveillance, military patrolling, and forced localization on reservations. And in fact, there are Kickapoos living in northern Mexico today who still have ties of affinity to the heartland, right? They understand this is a spiritually and nationally important place for the Kickapoo nation, even though many people living in the United States and in the heartland, would not consider them as key players in this story. And the larger part is that in terms of thinking about Native American histories, the human stories predate the stories of border enforcement, and that there are many heartlanders, in essence, in exile, who continue to struggle for the right to return.
Right. And with this term borderland in the academic sense, it's an idea that the people of an empire or a nation who are on a border could very well have more in common with people on the other side of the border than the people who live in the capital or the center. And in the imperial sense, they would say, oh, the vassals of the Byzantine Empire close to the border of Arabia have way more in common with the vassals of the Persian Empire on the border of Arabia. And we don't think about this concept with nation states because we have militarized borders, passport lines, immigration checks, yada, yada. But in the context of the Midwest, you mention this idea with the international cattle trade, and you use a term of multinational solidarity among Canadian traders and merchants and Midwestern cattle growers and others. And I'm in Kansas City, which used to have huge stockyards, and now it's full of hipster studio apartments. But what did this look like with the cattle trade and multinational solidarity?
Yeah, so this is a really important theme in the book, which has to do with sort of imagine communities, right? Like how people have considered themselves to be connected to people in other places. And one of the points is that I think there's been this longstanding trend in U.S. history writing, going back to the like antiquarian local histories of the 19th century, that have tried to wall in place, to start with bounded areas, to start with something like a town or a county, and then to fill in the lines and tell the stories of the people who live in those places without looking outward, without imagining that, in fact, those units don't really encapsulate human experience. And, of course, human experience has transcended town lines and county lines and state lines and regional lines. And so one of the points of the book is to get at these different webs of connection and then how people imagine themselves in place based on their relationships with other people, be they economic relationships, co-religionists, family relationships, and so forth. And a lot of the Midwestern agricultural press in the 19th century into the 20th century imagined the unit of analysis to be North American farmers, right, of the temperate zones. And they would often lump like the Midwest and places like Ontario together as a common agricultural unit. with farmers in that unit having common interests, that they would collaborate across national boundaries based on common investments. So, for example, if they were investing in shorthorn cattle, then farmers, regardless of their nationality, would have an investment in the breed. They would want that breed to do well against rival breeds. And then more generally, there was a lot of writing about farmers as a unit of analysis and a sense of agrarian solidarity around the world, which, of course, you know, and the rhetoric was more encompassing than it was in practice, because there were a lot of kind of racist and imperialist politics that affected senses of affinity. But nonetheless, there was a sense in agricultural writings and letters and so forth about farmers being a world-spanning kind of community. And one of the particular stories I tracked down was of a newspaper editor, H.L. Dunlap, who got a counselor post in Europe, which was not unusual at all for these small-town Midwestern newspaper editors and party hacks to get these political appointments to represent the United States overseas. And he was supposed to advance U.S. commercial interests. That was, you know, the main point of his job. But as he toured the countryside, he kept writing back about the conditions of farmers and expressing kind of all kinds of agrarian solidarity across borders. So in terms of, you know, thinking more generally, that's one of the things the book does, is map these connections. And let me just say one more thing that goes back to what I was talking about with birds, which also picks up on how these different sets of connections were conceived, is for the efforts to kind of track the life cycle or the different geographies of migrating birds in the early 20th century, a main unit of analysis was North America, north of Mexico. And so the thought was that was an ecological area, even while recognizing that many of the migratory birds wintered to the south of the United States. So the point was that there was some recognition that, yes, birds go to the Caribbean, they go to Mexico, to the Central America, to South America seasonally, but there was a sense of how this unit should be understood. It was definitely understood in more limited terms. So I guess the book gets at both, like, senses of connection, but also limits to some of those senses of connection.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Can you flesh out that idea for me? One thing you mentioned is that if you were to read the Old Farmer's Almanac in the 1910s, you would have articles about China, and you see a globalist mindset of people being aware of what's happening around the world if they're looking at something like a proto-futures market. So can you give an example of how that played out?
Yeah, so if you look at local newspapers from the Midwest from over a century ago, in fact, you will probably get more world news than local news. You know, there might be very short little snippets of local news, but a lot of the news, you know, is taken from other newspapers. And a lot of it is identified as coming from over the wire, right, being wired in through the telegraph system and later through radio as well. And I think, you know, if you do take the time to, you know, kind of go through some of this microfilm or, you know, the kind of yellowed, crumbling old pages of newspapers, you'll get a sense of just, you know, real broad-ranging geographic awareness. One of the things that has just been, you know, occupying my thoughts recently has to do with the coverage of disease. And the realization, this isn't in the book, but it fits with things that are in the book, about just how much coverage there was of plague outbreaks and dysentery outbreaks and measles outbreaks and polio outbreaks and so forth in other parts of the world. So part of it was, you know, imagining that other parts of the world were kind of more disease-ridden than the United States, but also understanding that, like, this is very proximate, right? That some of these, like, cholera outbreaks might be on immigrant ships. And the realization that people are mobile, that pathogens are mobile, that these things could happen at any day here at home. And in fact, rural school districts in the Midwest often shut down for periods of time when there were like diphtheria, mumps, other kind of epidemics passing through, that was not at all unusual. And again, some of these, epidemics across borders regularly cycled through even seemingly isolated places, distant from the far reaches of the world.
Well, I'm curious about the transition to our modern understanding of the heartland and how it changes from the period you're writing about, where people are globalist in some sense. Some people seem to live out the idea of the Thomas Jefferson's yeomanry, the educated farmer who works the land and cultivates things, but is also self-possessing of a lot of knowledge. Into the 20th century, whereas the United States fills out on both coasts and the heartland goes from this intersection of different cultures coming together in this borderland culture into something that seems a little bit backwards and reactionary compared to, where the real culture is happening on the coasts, where media sets up shop and in film, life is heavily depicting people in New York and Los Angeles, but very little in the Midwest, unless it's played out for comedy or, it's trying to show backwater people. How does this transition take place?
So part of it, I think, has to do with urbanization and, where big cities are. So places like Chicago are never considered as part of, the totally local, insular, isolated kind of heartland, that they're set apart and understood as places of global connection, as real world cities. So part of it has to do with differentiating between urban places and rural places. But I think the rural heartland has been conceived of as especially left behind or isolated. And I think that stems from an assumption that sort of geography is destiny. And by virtue of being in the middle of a major landmass, being in the middle of the country, the rural heartland is in fact a kind of a buffered heart. And in terms of the larger politics of that, I think this idea really is an artifact of the early Cold War. So originally the word heartland was all about power and the exercise of power. And the thought was whoever can control the Eurasian heartland will control the world. And then after that term became very commonly used in the United States during World War II and the early Cold War in reference to the Eurasian heartland, then people in the United States started to adopt it to their own heartland and especially to the industrial heartland, the thought being that that too is a locus of power and a place from which global dominance can be achieved. But at the same time that there were these celebrations of the heartland as a site of power, there was also a lot of anxiety in the early Cold War having to do with the prospect of nuclear annihilation and long-distance bombers and intercontinental ballistic missiles eventually that rendered every place unsafe. And I think in that context, the idea that like the oceans could protect the United States no longer made sense. And in that time of profound insecurity, there was a search for a kind of a safe place, right? A national safe place where there might be a protected inner essence, a real national heart. And that those global insecurities became conflated on the part of white nationalists with insecurities about what it meant to live in a multiracial democracy. And those two sets of concerns became kind of fused in the idea that there is this kind of interior place that is a kind of a backward-looking nostalgic place that we can latch onto as real America, as it were.
Well, I'm curious to tie these different ideas together. What your book is doing is rejecting the heartland myth that there's a stone solid core at the center of the nation. How do you think this myth is untrue? But then also, do you think that there are bits and pieces that are true? And I've grew up in a small town in Iowa, but I've also lived in a European capital with millions. And there are things that would be necessary for a life in a major metropole that simply don't make sense in a small town, of public transportation or not needing a firearm. That's just a different calculus in a very rural area. So the myths, what do you think is true and untrue about it? And what do you hope people will get out of your book to understand this?
I think a lot of the ideas of the heartland as being local, insulated, isolationist, you know, the true America, the quintessential America, are exactly what I just call them myths, right? That if you dig deeper into the past, you realize that like other parts of the country, even the rural Midwest, was global before it became local, that it's always been profoundly connected to other parts of the world, and that it's an invention to try to imagine it as some kind of walled off place. But that being said, I think, yes, there is some truth to the idea, you know, that people in the rural Midwest may be in some way local or provincial, but that's true for other parts of the country as well, is my point. That I think the myth kind of pins that all to one part of the country, thereby giving kind of the rest of the country a free pass, or enabling people in the rest of the country to identify themselves as somehow oppositional to these left behind localists in the heartland. And I should say, in terms of thinking about things like flyover states and the assumptions that undergird that line of thinking, that the flyovers are the cosmopolitan people who can literally look down on the localized people below, that has its own provincialism, right? That it really, I think, misreads what the people on the ground are like, their own circuits of connection, their own ability to be flyers over, their own sense of themselves as people who are in hierarchies, not on the bottom, but actually people who have been empowered relative to other people around the world. And it's important to keep those lessons in mind as well.
Well, as a Midwesterner, I endorse your thesis. So hope other people will take a look at it. And your book is The Heartland, an American History. Kristen, if people want to find your book or find out what you're up to, is there a good place to find you online?
Yeah, so the best way is just Google me, right? And you'll find my Illinois website. And then as for finding the book, that it's available wherever books are sold.
All right. Well, I'll include that in the show notes. Kristen, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Scott.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French-Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.